During the last several years, a new phrase has appeared in the vocabulary of Jewish life. It's the label Torah True. Torah means instruction. And in our tradition, the Torah is, of course, the sum of God's instructions. It's the shorthand word we use to describe the shape, the form, the mandates, the commandments of Jewish life, the revelation. And over the long centuries, each generation understood Torah to be the existential shape, form, structure of Jewish life as it was known in their day. And piety led them to ascribe that halacha, that way, to Moses as receiving the prophecy of it at Mount Sinai. Some few years ago, a number within the traditional community began to apply the phrase Torah True to themselves, in the first instance to separate themselves from all others, from us, to suggest that we had fallen away while they had remained loyal and true. And as a way of suggesting that they really were the true Israel, and we who had supposedly fallen away were not. Now, the emphasis among those who talked of being Torah true was on form, the formal, the shape, observance, custom. And unfortunately, many of them forgot that the shape, the custom, the formal, the ritual has always been in Judaism simply a means of symbolizing, of driving home, of suggesting the spiritual and ethical truths which lie at the very heart of our tradition and give it life. And so one of the unhappy truths about the Torah true is that an inordinate number of them have been involved in currency scandals and in the misappropriation of government funds for their institutions in Israel. A number of them in the United States have been involved in nursing home scandals and the like. I hasten to add, and I want you to understand as we talk about the Torah true, that they do not represent the entirety or even the majority of those who are traditional or Orthodox. It's a particular militancy within Orthodoxy itself. Some months ago, the Quarterly Judaism published an interesting autobiographical piece by a man who had been the chief rabbi of the Union of South Africa. Pious, lovely, orthodox, learned man, who described a scene. He had been on the train from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. A young Torah trunik had sat down next to him, who was studying at one of the yeshivas in Jerusalem. And they had talked of matters Talmudic. As he got off the train, he went to put on his hat. He had a kippah, a yarmulke on, but he went to put on his hat. And accidentally, as he put on his hat, he knocked his kippah, his head covering off, and he took a few steps to pick up the hat and pick up the kippah. And this youngster who had been sitting next to him began to berate this learned, elderly, pious man for having violated the law. Because someplace in the depths of the niceties of the Talmud, there's a rule that you shouldn't take more than four steps bareheaded. Well, first of all, chutzpah, young in age, ignorance against learning. But what was most interesting to this elderly man was that they then got on a city bus in Jerusalem, and the young man proceeded to sit himself directly under one of those signs that you see with a cigarette and a big X through it, who says, "Lo ta'ashen, you shall not smoke." And he proceeded to pick out a cigarette and to light it up, and the rabbi couldn't avoid going up to him and saying, "No." And the youngster said, "That's not for us." Even the rules of society, the rules of courtesy, the rules of safety in a Jewish state are not for them. The only rule which they recognize is the four L's of the halakha, and within that, really, they concentrate on the formal, on the external, on the shape, on the custom. In part, out of a reaction to the mass of Jews, us, who have paid very little attention to the externals, to the shape, to the form, and to the custom. So when I speak of the Torah true, I speak not of the entirety of the traditional Jewish community. And there are certainly many men, learned men, scholars, and rabbis within it who would echo at least some of the strictures and the sentiments which I'm going to speak this morning. But it's also true that the Torah true have become a political force in Israel, and increasingly that force is encroaching on Jewish life outside of Israel. And because of political coercion, because of the peculiarities of the Israeli political system, it's important that we understand what is involved and the cost, the potential cost of what is involved, and some of the dangers that will beset us here in America, here in the Jewish community of America, because of what these people are doing. Now, perhaps the best way to introduce this to you is to read to you a few brief paragraphs from a fine Orthodox Jewish scholar and rabbi who now lives in Israel, a former rabbi from Montreal in Canada named David Hartman, who retired from his pulpit some years ago and is now a professor of philosophy at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Immediately after the last election, when all the arrangements were being made to bring a coalition government into being because Mr. Begin no longer had a coalition simply from within his own party and those politically like his, when the small religious parties had an inordinate voice in the forming of that coalition, David Hartman published the following essay, of which I read to you a brief section in the Jerusalem Post. During the past few weeks, Israeli society has witnessed a secretive and sinister attempt by certain political forces form a government that would allegedly further religious interests and values. Undoubtedly, the major political parties, which are predominantly secular in spirit, have always made arrangements with the so-called religious groups in order to further their own secular goals and aspirations. Nevertheless, because of the current behavior of the rabbinate and of other political power groups, the majority of Israelis are more convinced than ever that Judaism in Israel is an instrument with which to strike backroom political deals rather than a prophetic call to the intense love of God and moral integrity. Judaism has thus been disgraced in the eyes of the community by its so-called religious leadership. Instead of bringing the message of Judaism freely and openly into the marketplace of Jewish life, it has turned Torah into an object of political agreements between ministers and the Israeli government and so-called religious sectors of the community who believe that love for Torah demands detachment from the community. Whereas the Torah teaches us that the greatest commandment is study and reflection, that only through learning can one develop love of God, our government believes that through political pressure we will bring Judaism to the Jewish people. There is a feeling of shame among people genuinely committed to Judaism. They are embarrassed by the way Judaism has been vulgarized and exploited by political pressure groups. The secular forces in Israel must be gloating with joy at the triumph of secularism in Israel. Thanks to the coalition discussions and agreements, another great wall has been established between God's word and the people of Israel. Once again, the name of God has been disgraced in the public marketplaces of Jewish life. The way we have dealt with the problem of conversion illustrates this ugly process. And I'll speak of that problem in just a moment. So what I am saying to you is not an attack by a Reform rabbi in Orthodox Judaism. It is a concern expressed by many across the spectrum of Jewish life about an emphasis on form, shape, ancient custom at the expense of the moral and spiritual integrity of our tradition. It is a concern that political coercion and religious short-sightedness are conspiring to bring our tradition into disgrace in the eyes of many, will create divisions within Israel and within the Jewish community in the diaspora, which will not easily be healed and must be a source of concern to all. Now, what is the situation? How did all this begin? When Israel came into being in 1948, the majority party, the Mapai, the Labor Party, had a clear majority of the seats in the Knesset. But nevertheless, it decided to bring the what was called then the Mizrahi, the National Religious Party, into a coalition. There's an old Jewish principle called Shalom Bayit, you do a lot to keep peace in the house. You listen to the children when they're not worth listening to. But in this case, the secular socialists, the Mapai, decided that they ought really simply to, in matters of personal status, to maintain the situation which had existed under the mandate. For millennia, not simply for centuries, but for thousands of years, the ancient Middle East has had a form of social organization which is called the millet community. This means simply that there's a government, a king, a sheikh, someone. And the government has the power of taxation and controls foreign policy. But in matters that have to do with religious life, which have to do with personal status, marriage, divorce, burial, adoption, inheritance, in matters which are at issue between two people within the same religious community, it's been the pattern for centuries in the Middle East to allow the religious groups to govern themselves by their own religious law. And the British continued that when they took over from the Turks. There was a Beit Din and a rabbinic community which governed the establishment of, which governed the Jewish laws of personal status. There was a Coptic law, there was a Greek Orthodox law, the Qadis ruled in the Muslim community. And for a variety of reasons, including the fact that they recognized that there had to be something Jewish about a Jewish state, the secular socialist majority at the founding of the state gave to the rabbinate the right to continue the authorities which they had enjoyed under the British, under the mandate. And they weren't particularly worried. They were a majority. They didn't think the religious parties, which numbered less than 10% of the electorate, would be able to accomplish very much. And besides that, if they didn't like a particular ruling, let's say in marriage, all they had to do was to live together as common law man and wife. The marriage was established, and that was the end of the matter. So the rabbinate became politicized. The fundamental structure of the Jewish state gave to the traditional rabbinate control of all these areas of personal status. And as the state began to divide more and more among a variety of political parties, though the number of people who voted for the religious parties remained about constant, about 10% of the population, the power of these small splinter groups grew from election to election. By the fourth Knesset, we've now had 10, by the fourth Knesset, the Labor Party could not form a coalition without the National Religious Party. By the time when Mr. Begin and the Likud overthrew the Labor Party, the National Religious Party and now the splinter religious parties were absolutely essential to the forming of a coalition. And as their political importance grew, their demands grew. And soon Israel found itself not only having a calendar which established the Sabbath as the day of rest, but having a society in which the public transport could not move about on the Sabbath. So the hospitals found themselves challenged on their rights to perform autopsies. All manner of rules that were traditional as far as divorce and inheritance and adoption, conversion, became more or less the enforced norm. Enforced now not by the voluntary will of a congregation who claimed themselves to be Orthodox to say, this is the way we're going to live, but they now have the power of the state behind them. And of course, power corrupts. And any number of these people who became involved in the apparatus of the state, who began to use the state coercively for their own purposes, and this was particularly visible in the public school system. Israel has a complex school system. There is a state school and there are the religious schools. And obviously the religious schools, as in America, will teach whatever the parochial schools wish to teach. But more and more, the national religious parties insisted that it must be state policy, that their creationism, their forms of fundamental religious approach must be the norm which is somehow presented in the schools themselves. Now, in the last election, which was, as you recall, almost a dead heat between the Labour coalition and Mr. Begin's coalition, the National Religious Party and the Oriental Religious Party held the balance of power. And in the hard bargaining which Mr. Begin had to undertake in order to form a coalition, the religious parties won a number of major concessions, which can have important economic, political, military, and religious connotations for the state. As an example, one of the conditions of the formation of Mr. Begin's government was that the Sabbath must be observed by all industry and all transport in which there is federal involvement. The ports must be closed. El Al must not fly. Now, El Al, 2 years ago, lost $40 million, a sum of money which a little state like Israel can ill afford. And a vast program of retrenchment was in effect, and El Al was almost beginning to fly on time. Now, this new ruling will mean that El Al will have to close down 2 of the 7 days of the week. Because of the time changes between New York and Paris and Israel, and because the law in Israel is not only must the ports be closed for 24 hours, but they must be closed sufficiently early for the workers to be home for the Sabbath and to leave at the end of the Sabbath to get back to the port. Now, El Al cannot survive under these kinds of economic restrictions, but that's the rule that's being put into effect. And Israel will not only lose the great sums of money on its national carrier, but it obviously will not be able to compete internationally. And we must remember that a passenger carrier is not simply a source of income, but an important military asset, ultimately, to a state. And what is true, of course, was that it would become increasingly difficult for and undesirable for tourists to visit Israel. If you suddenly find yourself unable for a 48-hour period to leave, if some emergency will arise, if you find schedules are impossible because of the way the blue laws are observed, people who have no particular reason to go to Israel besides the desire to visit there for a week or so will find reasons to go elsewhere easily and clearly. Today, 1 out of every 2 tourists who comes to Israel is non-Jewish, and that number has been increasing and will quickly decrease. In this coalition bargaining, they received agreement that hospital administration in Israel will be governed by the halakha, which is to say that the rabbis will have final say in a whole variety of things in which rabbis ought not to have any say. They will rule as to whether an autopsy is permitted or not. They will rule as to whether an abortion is permitted or not. They will rule as to whether certain kinds of medical research should be undertaken or not. And believe me, the rabbis who will do this ruling will be insensitive to the kinds of conditions and ethical problems which physicians and ethicians and some of us might be aware of today. Great sums of money are to be invested in the yeshivot, in the religious schools. There's an agreement that sums of money must be provided to provide housing for yeshiva students and their wives, even though other segments of the society may not have such housing provided for them. The exemption of religious women from the military was increased, and there is an interesting exemption of one who's called a Baal Tshuva, that is one who has suddenly become Orthodox from religious service. Perhaps the most potentially damaging of all of the agreements that were entered into was Mr. Begin's agreement that if he can't find the votes, he will submit to the Knesset a bill which will amend the law of return, which is the law that any Jew may come to Israel and find their haven and safety and citizenship, so that the definition of a Jew will be one who has been born of a Jewish mother or who has been converted kahalacha, according to the halacha, by rabbinic authority. Now, Orthodox Judaism is not eager to make converts. It has not felt that the pressures of life in our pluralistic society should let it make it let down any of the restrictions it has traditionally held against conversion. And more to the point, all those whom I have converted, whom any Reformed rabbi, any conservative rabbi has converted, all those people will be under this new ruling seen as non-Jews. They, and if they are women, their children and their grandchildren to the nth generation. Which means we will have introduced into the Jewish community, because of Israeli law, not because of religious law, because the religious law could not impose this on its own, we'll have introduced into the Jewish community a principle of division, which has no place in a small community, which can only create havoc. Why should Jews in America, who are second, third generation Jews in their own minds, but not in the minds of the Orthodox rabbis who are in this political structure in Israel, bother to be concerned about the security and the safety of Israel? Why should they give to the United Jewish Appeal? Already there have been pressures in some of the communities to have the federations begin to take strong and effective political action against Mr. Begin to try to coerce him, to pressure him not to do what he has undertaken to do. Already the Council of Jewish Federations Welfare Funds has taken a stand at a council meeting, not its General Assembly, which is next week, to avoid the issue. And this time I'm sure they'll be able to avoid it on the grounds that it's a matter of domestic Israeli politics. But they won't be able to avoid it for long, because it will not be long before the large Reform and conservative communities in the United States say, how long should we continue to support governments which spit in our face, which say to us, we look upon you as non-Jews, we look upon the action of your religious leaders as contemptible and unacceptable, and yet we want you to give us handouts, we want you to give us all the things that we require for support. Now this movement to oppose, to withhold, is just beginning. And the Federation community, the United Jewish Appeal community, is going to have to face it, because the pressures will not relent unless the whole political situation in Israel changes. And the political situation in Israel will not change unless one of several things happens. One is that the Israelis themselves combine in some way so as to destroy the power of these religious groups. That is, the League Against Religious Coercion, which exists, or some other new band of peoples come together and they elect a majority of the Knesset and simply disallow all these special privileges which the Torah true have achieved. Or unless sufficient pressure is brought from the diaspora before permanent divisions are created which are not to anyone's benefit. Now the problem is a serious one. I don't want to minimize either its complexity or its seriousness or to suggest to you that they're simple and neat solutions. Most of us believe deep down, implicitly and simply, in the separation of church and state. It's interesting, we never thought we'd have a problem of the separation of church and synagogue, did we? And we're proud that our Constitution speaks of the fact that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. But I'd like to suggest to you that even in America, even especially in America, the problem is not easily resolved. When the Founding Fathers spoke of the disestablishment of religion, they meant simply that every religious community should have the right to worship in its own way. And since they lived in colonies where almost nobody was not a Christian, and in most colonies nobody was not a Protestant Christian of one variety or another, they thought that Protestant Christian values would permeate the society, and what they're really talking about is the right of Methodists and Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Puritans to have their own churches. But the problem is not so neat or so easy, because religion is not simply what one does 2 hours a week on Sunday or on the Shabbat. Religion is a whole cluster of ideas, of institutions, of rituals, of hopes, of values by which a society or a group within a society draw together the confusions of life and shape them into some kind of meaning. Inevitably, every religious tradition has a unique vision Inevitably, every religious tradition has a unique understanding of what's right and what's wrong. Inevitably, every religious tradition has its own special way of understanding how the social order should be shaped. And inevitably, each religious tradition conflicts in part with the shape that other religions hold as to morals, ethics, social structure, political organization, the family, and the like. We've only to see look at the testimony in Congress this last week between a right-wing conservative rabbi and the president of the Council of Bishops of the Roman Catholic Church on the one hand, and the liberal Christian and liberal Jewish community on the other, on the issue of the constitutional amendment having to do with abortion. You can see it also on the issue of prayer in the public schools. In the United States, we fought really for a century and a half before a majority of people in the United States recognized that what we called public schools were in fact Protestant schools. They were organized to celebrate Christmas and Easter. Most who went to these schools could not understand that Christian values, and I don't mean simply religious worship values, could not be promulgated in the school, or the Christian point of view on any one of a dozen issues. It's only recently that we have been able to abolish the practice of prayer as the beginning of public school session, despite the large number of secularists who are in American society. And just 2 days ago, I read in one of our local papers that in a county outside of Columbus, the school board had just agreed to, in federal court, to abolish a practice which had been in existence for many, many years, of having 15 minutes of devotion at the beginning of every religious school session, and having the children memorize lines from the Bible, which means obviously Old Testament and the New Testament, to use their terms, as lines around which they can form their character and which, being in their consciousness, will become their values, supposedly, for the rest of their lives. Every one of us assumes that our religious values, and I don't mean simply the way we worship, but our sense of what's right and wrong, our sense of how society should be organized, ought to be the way everybody in the society is organized, follows, agrees to be right. Now, when there were small social units, the clan, the family, the tribe was religiously homogeneous, uniform, and there was no conflict in terms of church and state, synagogue and state. The Near Eastern model, which I set before you, the millet community, solved this problem neatly. There could be a large country, but within it, every religious group had elbow room to practice, to live by its own code of conduct. But then in our wisdom or unwisdom, we decided around the 16th century to create something called the nation state and something called citizenship. And citizenship means not only the plus one person, one vote, but it means the problem. Each person feeling that he has the right to have a say in how the society should be organized, and majority not understanding why minorities should have the right to say nay to values, attitudes, and social forms which they believe to be valid. And no nation on the face of this earth has resolved successfully the problem of how to deal with the difference in religious vision, in religious values, which is implicit in a heterogeneous society. You can do it coercively, as the Soviet Union does, or China does, but if you begin to allow people freedom, there's going to be conflict, there's going to be confusion. And we can see it across our own land. We've moved from an era in which we tried to maximize freedom, to say each person has the right to follow his own values. You can turn off your own television set. You don't have to read every book that comes down the pike. There ought not to be worship in the public schools, to a time when large segments of the society are saying that's a religious value in itself, and it is one which is antithetical to the values which are ours. We want to return the public schools to what they were 50 years ago, when they were really pale but important extensions of our Protestant tradition, or they now tend to talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition. So the problem is a basic one. It's an unresolved one. None of us really knows how to create a social order which does not reflect in a major and often coercive way the values of the majority within that community. And if you want to follow out this problem, look at the question of Sunday blue laws, look at the issue of cross-religious adoptions, look at the issue, most recent issue, and perhaps the best one to look at, the whole question of the attitude towards abortion. America hasn't solved the problem of the separation of church and state. It will not be solved neatly here. It'll be solved politically, and there'll be change back and forward. It's going to be a series of very bitter political battles, and Israel will face that too. So I can't come before you and say that if only the rabbis would be deprived of certain rights, that will in and of itself resolve the problem in Israel. That's not true. Nor can I say to you that I cannot, that I must condemn those who have strong commitments which are different than my own. I have strong commitments also. I'm just fortunate to live in a society which for the last 30 years or so has more or less reflected most of the strong commitments which are my own. And so I've not seen as a maverick, and you have not seen as mavericks. But in Israel, in our little country, that is the country where the Jewish problem must work itself out. In Israel, the problem is a dangerous one, and it's coming to the point where Israel may go the way of Iran. There is the possibility, if the religious minority gets a hold, gets power, that it will, you know, try to reimpose the whole panoply of the Middle Ages. There's the possibility that it, since every action breeds an equal and opposite reaction, there will be a recurrence of very strident secularism in Israel. In Israel, you know, the religious parties are called the Dati, and you and I, though we are religious, would be called low Dati. We call ourselves non-religious, though in fact we are. I think the best I can say to you is this, that we must prize commitment, and even when those commitments differ than our own, we must misprize political coercion, and we must have only contempt for those who teach a theology of contempt. Because implicit in much that is happening within the circles of the Torah true is a teaching of contempt for all other Jews. Just before Rosh Hashanah this last year, one of the religious parties in Israel, the Aguda, published in the press a rabbinic announcement which said, in effect, that no one should go and worship in the conservative congregations that are in Israel because God doesn't hear the prayers of conservative Jews. Remind me of Reverend Smith, and we got all hot and bothered about that, but here were Jews saying the same thing. They didn't have to mention Reform. I mean, that they knew was already trafe. It's too bad. But I think there's one thing that we must do, all of us. And I think that many Reformed and conservative Jews must become aware that the way we are carrying on our religious life is wholly legitimate and is not a cut-down version of legitimate Torah-true Judaism. The Torah-true play on the idea that we have changed, we have cut away, we have weakened, because we are indifferent, we don't care enough about. If we did care enough about, we'd go the whole way. And since they never quite use the phrase that we go whole hog. But in point of fact, liberal Judaism, conservative or constructionist, reform, non-Orthodox Judaism is a wholly legitimate modulation of Judaism, as legitimate as the modulation which is called rabbinic. Yes, some Reformed Jews became Reformed Jews, and some conservative Jews became conservative Jews because they didn't want to bother keeping kosher in their homes. And some Reformed Jews and some conservative Jews became Reformed because it just didn't make any difference anymore. This wasn't a symbol which had significance to them. And because as they looked at the tangle and the web of the tradition, all these customs, they saw superstition, they saw ignorance, they saw confusion that was taking people's minds away from the central theses, morality, spirituality, and making the form increasingly and overbidingly, overwhelmingly important. Rabbinic Judaism is a reform of biblical Judaism. Most of what the Orthodox Jews say Moses said, Moses received from God on Mount Sinai, is what some rabbi saw his community doing and said this is right and somehow drew it into what we call Torah. The strong point of traditional Judaism is not history. Everything is Torah, and Torah is Sinai, and therefore everything comes from God. Well, that's simply not true. Most of the things we think as quintessentially Jewish, Moses never heard about. Moses never met a rabbi, however orthodox he is. Moses never entered a synagogue. Moses never saw a Sefer Torah. If I took him to the Sefer Torah in the Ark and opened it up for him, he couldn't read it because his Hebrew was written in a different character forms than ours. Most of what's there was written 400, 500, 600 years after he died. I don't mean to diminish or denigrate Moses in any way, but Moses was not an Orthodox Jew. Moses was a biblical Jew. And Akiba is, you know, a rabbinic Jew. Daniel Silver is a Reformed Jew, and we are all good Jews. And that's the point. Most non-Orthodox Jews accept the Orthodox position that they are true and somehow we're less. And I'll hate to tell you how many times I've been at some home and their family's been a fine, loyal member of the temple for generations. In fact, they may even have come to shul from time to time. And they'll say to me, you know, my parents were good, so-and-so, whichever parent it is, was a good Jew, but wasn't pious. We define piety, again, in purely traditional terms, and that's wrong. Ours is legitimate, our form's legitimate, their forms are legitimate. There is such a thing as in Cleveland as the Congregation of Plenum, which is a group of rabbis and of the presidents, past presidents of all the congregations in Cleveland. I'm very proud of it. It's the only group of its kind in the country, and we worked very hard to bring it into being. We've been able to bring it into being because there are former rabbis like myself who are willing to say that not all Orthodox are Torah true, and because that there are Orthodox rabbis who are willing to say Daniel Silver isn't an Epicurus. But at the same time, we had a meeting last week of young leaders from all of these congregations. It's part of a long series that's being put together to help them come to meet one another as religious Jews across the community. And those among the young people who came out of traditional congregations, there was immediately a demand that somehow we define who is a good Jew. It's interesting. Who is a good Jew? Now, that evening, somehow it stayed on the level of whether you believed in God or not. But what was implicit in that is that a good Jew is somehow a Jew who does all the Jews ought to do by rabbinic standards, and some, if you don't, you're something less. What I tried to say that last night, what I would say to you again and again and again, is that you're good Jews, but I have no right to say it, and an Orthodox rabbi has no right to judge you otherwise. Good and bad are judgments which belong to God. Only God will ultimately decide whether we are good people or bad people, we did it the right way or the wrong way. We have to decide whether it's the way that fits us, whether it's the way through which we grow, whether we are serious about the commitments we talk about, or they're simply, you know, formal, empty, vague statements. I ultimately don't know who is the good Jew, which implies, you know, who's the better Jew. What I do know are who are the Jews who are involved with the survival of Judaism, who are the Jews who care about Israel, who are the Jews who support the institutions of our community, who are the Jews who read, who understand, who know, who think, who are the Jews who understand that you should love your neighbor, even if he's an Orthodox Jew like yourself, or you shouldn't love your neighbor even if he's a Reformed Jew like yourself and not misprize him. Definitions create divisions. That's the problem with the law of conversion in Israel. It's a time we get over this issue of definitions. It's a time that we recognize that there are only 12 or 13 million Jews in a world of 4 billion people. And a little community like ours, which is struggling to survive, to retain a critical mass, can hardly afford, hurling epithets at each other, creating divisions so we won't work with each other, with anybody who's not like us, the non-Torah true. Much less can we tolerate the Torah true violating the Sabbath by hurling stones, at those who are driving past. It takes a great deal of humility to be able to say, I am firmly committed to, yet I respect your point of view. And that's a position that many Reformed Jews did not have, perhaps some do still do not have about orthodoxy. Many Reformed Jews still carry about within themselves an assumption that Orthodox Jews are illiterate or they're immigrant. They haven't become acculturized as yet. And many Orthodox Jews carry around, and unfortunately are now being encouraged by some of their teachers and some of their schools to believe the Reformed Jews, conservative Jews, are fallen away, are people who have set materialism, luxury, indulgence, ease above a hard, commitment to one's life. Well, I think we could resolve these problems here in America because God knows the synagogue is not going to become the state. But in Israel, the problems will not be easily resolved. And unless they are resolved, I'm afraid that there's going to be a spillover which will affect even here. Because this much is clear to me, that there are already organizations in being in the non-Torah true community which are determined, who are determined to use their economic leverage to affect changes in Israel. Whether they will be able to achieve this or not is problematic. But in the organization themselves, there's a new principle of division, divisiveness. And yet I cannot fault them for organizing, because they are organizing in their own mind in order to preserve the unity of the Jewish people. A final paradox, and with this I close. The group in Israel which is fomenting most of this Torah true Nickism is called the Aguda. The Aguda is a group, a small group of mostly Eastern European traditionalists who for four generations before the establishment of the State of Israel fought against the establishment of the State of Israel. That's why the youngster in the bus couldn't care less whether he's told to smoke or not to smoke. That's why their youngsters do not serve in the military and have never even agreed to serve in non-military functions. Here is an anti-Zionist, ultra-Orthodox, form-conscious group which is now dictating the religious policies of the State of Israel because of the peculiarities of coalition politics. It's a tragedy of the First Order. It's a tragedy which some of the Orthodox rabbis here in this country and in Israel recognize, but not the established rabbinate of Israel, I hasten to add. The rabbis who have spoken out in Israel, the Orthodox rabbis, are all men who have made Aliyah. They all come from the West. The rabbis who are in Israel, who serve the chief rabbis, who serve as provincial rabbis, are part of a religious establishment which is as entrenched, as politicized, as the Catholic Church ever was in medieval Europe. Will we resolve this? Not quickly. Does Jewish life require this? Not at all. Do we need to get over it? Yesterday. Amen.